From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. For today's episode, we have a very special guest, Dr. Narushige Michishita. He is a professor at the National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies in Tokyo, and he is currently here in D.C. as a Japan scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center's Asia program. Dr. Michishita participated in KEI's academic symposium this year, where we took experts to serve on panels at the International Studies Association conference in Atlanta. And he's here today to share some of his findings and talk about his other research on security in Asia. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
So to get started, your paper for KEI was called Deciphering China's Security Intentions in Northeast Asia, the Japanese Debate. Mm-hmm. Can you start by giving us and giving our listeners a brief summary of your paper and some of the interesting findings?
Right. What I did was in order to understand how Japanese policymakers and as well as people are thinking about China and particularly focusing on its security intentions, I've taken a look at four different sets of sources. One is Japanese government views as well as political party views. There are two major political parties. One is a Liberal Democratic Party, which is a currently ruling party, LDP, and the other one is a Democratic Party of Japan, DPJ, which is now opposition. And the second one is a Ministry of Defense, because this is the most important government organization in charge of kind of addressing Chinese security challenges. And the third one is major newspapers. I took a look at three major newspapers, Yomiuri Shimbun, and Asahi Shimbun, and the Nihon Keizai Shimbun. And Yomiuri is a conservative, which has a largest number of circulation in Japan. Asahi is also the major newspaper, which is slightly liberal, so it's a good combination, one conservative, but the other liberal. And Nihon Keizai Shimbun is the name is actually Japanese Economic News Daily. That means it represents business interests. And finally, fourth source that I look at was public opinion. There are, you know, large number of different sources, so took a look at different public opinion polls and whose results. Yeah. So let me just talk about the major findings of the research. First, when I looked at governmental as well as party views about China, there were interesting differences between ruling LDP and the opposition DPJ, because LDP was more kind of attentive to the challenges and threats that China is posing to Japan. Whereas DPJ certainly understand the challenges, but does not really regard Chinese challenges as a dire, you know, imminent threat. And so there is a nuanced difference, although they agree, both of them agree that China is a challenge, posing security challenge to Japan. And also in terms of policy prescription, they kind of disagree with each other, where the LDP, particularly under the Prime Minister, Mr. Shinzo Abe, who is the current Prime Minister of Japan, who is conservatively oriented, he is very much interested in Japan making a contribution to regional security, not only to the, you know, strengthen the defense of Japan, defense capability for Japan, but also he thinks that Japan has to play a larger role to contribute to peace and stability in Asia. And for that purpose, he has actually made the decision to reinterpret the Japanese constitution so that Japan can now start exercising the right of collective self-defense, which is a strange term. But what it really means is simple. If somebody else in the region is attacked by somebody else, like China, it used to be that Japan could not help the country which was attacked. But now, because Japan can exercise this collective self-defense right, Japan can come to help by using force in some extreme cases. So that's a change. And Mr. Abe is also talking about strengthening regional security partnership, and particularly with some key countries such as Australia, India, and Southeast Asian countries. And actually, Korea is another candidate, although Korea-Japan relationship is not doing too well, so it's kind of a left-out agenda, but he's trying to do it. But on the other hand, DPJ is more focused solely on the defense of Japan. So it talks about how to defend the Senkaku Island and how to secure Japanese interest, but it doesn't really talk about regional security. In terms of defense ministry, I took a look at defense white paper of 2015. And found interesting things. The Ministry of Defense tend to make two interesting arguments about China. One is that the Ministry of Defense always says that Chinese military expenditure has been growing so rapidly that China is a threat. And another argument is that Chinese policy is not transparent, therefore it's scary or challenging. But I kind of take issues with this, somewhat critical of these observations, because military expenditure per se is not necessarily a problem, because even now, China is the second largest spender on defense in the world. But in terms of a proportion of defense expenditure in its gross domestic product, China spends only 1.9%, whereas the United States spends like 3.3%, South Korea 2.5%. So, you know, China is not necessarily spending too much on defense. So that's one problem I have. And another thing is a lack of transparency. I don't agree with the contention that Chinese policy is not transparent, because China has been quite transparent in what it stands for. It has been clearly stating that if Taiwan goes independent, China would attack it. This is very transparent position, and has said that large areas in the South China Sea belongs to China. This is a overblown statement or argument, but still it's clearly stated. So I don't think it's the problem is a lack of transparency in Chinese policy, but kind of assertiveness or expansionist nature of the policy. And the third one, in terms of media arguments, I found interesting difference between Asahi and Yomiuri, which was not too surprising, because Yomiuri was saying, basically taking a conservative position, China is a threat, we have to do more on defense, and we have to secure Senkaku, da-da-da-da. And Asahi is a little bit more liberal, emphasizing more on dialogue. Certainly talks about defense and capabilities, but upon that, Asahi Shimbun really emphasizes dialogue. And there is another interesting difference. Whereas Yomiuri regarded Mr. Xi Jinping, the president of China, as the source of the problem. But on the other hand, Asahi regarded the hardliners within the Chinese leadership around Mr. Xi was a problem. And they came up with the interpretation where Xi is, you know, doing whatever she is doing under pressure of the coming from the hardline, not coming out of himself. So there is an interesting interpretational difference. And Nikkei Shimbun, for obvious reasons, emphasized the importance of securing the South China Sea, because it's trade interactions and transportation is so concentrated in the area. And finally, public opinion. I found Japanese public opinion to be very sober and reasonable, because I think partly because Japanese people have experienced and has gone through this volatile period of crisis over the Senkaku Island, tensions, history issue with China. And so they used to become quite emotional, and there was a lot of public uproar about things. But now we have seen all these and still understand the needs of maintaining and hopefully improve Sino-Japanese relationship. So they are not overly optimistic, but they are not overly pessimistic. So that was interesting.
I'm curious, some of these differences you're seeing, for example, the government in power right now with Prime Minister Abe saying that, you know, collective self-defense is important, China is a threat, etc., and then the public opinion being a lot more subdued. Mm-hmm. Is the government doing anything to close that gap and to, I guess, convince the public that something should be done?
Well, actually, in terms of how to perceive China, there is not much gap between the government position, even Mr. Abe's position, and the general public. They are all concerned. But the difference is when it comes to how to respond to it and how to, you know, in terms of prescription, there are differences. And in which Mr. Abe is basically saying China is a challenge. We have to take care of it and we have to address it. And as a responsible, you know, big power, a major power in the region, we have to take the leadership of preparing certain level of defense capabilities, creating a regional security partnership and all that, and, you know, strengthening U.S.-Japan alliance. But the general public are divided on this. Some people support Mr. Abe. Mr. Abe's support rate is pretty high even now, so people support him in order to address the challenges posed by China. But there are other people who don't necessarily like what Mr. Abe is doing because they are concerned about possible entrapment of Japan into regional conflict or tensions. For example, if there is a use of force or some kind of limited conflict in the South China Sea between China and Vietnam or between China and the Philippines, would Japan be willing to, you know, engage in the situation? That's a tough call to make, right? And, you know, Japanese people some people say Japan has been pacifist, right? But it's not true. Japan has never been pacifist. It's a isolationist. The idea was we don't want to get entangled into messy wars here in the Middle East, in Asia. So we didn't want to engage in foreign wars. And Mr. Abe made it kind of possible for Japan to do it. So people are very upset. We don't want to, you know, send our service members in harm's way. And that's a sentiment. And that's understandable. So there is a choice to make for people. And for the time being, Mr. Abe is still in charge. And people basically support, maybe not necessarily support, but endorse and approve what he's doing. But there are latent sentiment of isolationism in Japan.
So moving a little bit outside of this paper, which focused mainly on China, do you have a sense of the Japanese public or media perspective on other issues in Northeast Asia? And given that we're the Korea Economic Institute, we're really interested as well in North Korea.
Yeah, sure. North Korea is a big headache to Japan. And there is a really solid consensus on this issue among the government, media, and the people, in which people regard North Korea as a military threat, as well as even a kind of personal level threat. Military threat because North Korea has been developing nuclear weapons and missiles. North Korea has tested four nuclear explosion tests and have been conducting missile tests, launch tests, and has actually already deployed more than 200 medium-range ballistic missiles capable of reaching Japan within 10 minutes. So that's a threat. And now, because North Korea has conducted four nuclear tests, experts assess that North Korea might have succeeded in developing miniaturized usable nuclear weapons. So Japan might be under a nuclear threat coming from North Korea today. Second is North Korea's threat can be personal because as it's been widely known, North Korea has abducted at least 17 Japanese citizens in the 1970s and 80s. And so this has become a really highly politicized, emotional issue in Japan. And so it could happen to anybody, right, in living in Japan. So people regard it as a, you know, important problem. So North Korea is a concern, and government is taking military as well as diplomatic measures, including economic sanctions, to address the issue.
So you are currently here at the Wilson Center, and your project there is called A Comparative Study on Military Strategies in Asia During the Cold War and at the Present Time. So I'm wondering, have you found any major parallels between the current situation and the Cold War? And if you could tell us a little bit about what you have found.
Yeah, I mean, there are interesting similarities between what the Soviet Union was doing during the Cold War and what China is doing today. For example, the Soviets' objective in the Pacific was to prevent the U.S. Offensive forces to approach Soviet Far East. So in order to achieve that goal, Soviet Union decided to draw two defense lines, one called Sea Control Line, the other called Sea Denial Line, and deployed submarines, surface ships, and long-range bombers in order to fend off the U.S. strike forces. What China is doing today is, again, in order to prevent U.S. forces to coming close to the Chinese East Coast, China has decided to draw two defense lines, One is called the First Island Chain. The other is called Second Island Chain. And deploying submarines, surface ships, and, you know, now long-range bombers are still under development. Good ones are still under development, but developing capabilities to fend off the approach of U.S. strike forces. And so these are very similar. There are certainly differences. One is that during the Cold War, the Soviet Union was using this Kuril Island chain, which is kind of starts from the southern tip of Kamchatka Peninsula through to the northern tip of Hokkaido, Japanese island, as a natural barrier to stop the U.S. forces. China is talking about First Island Chain, which is kind of converged with what's called the Ryukyu Island in Japanese, southwestern islands. But these southwestern islands are Japanese territories. So this time around, Japan and the United States can use this island chain as a barrier or, you know, defense line. So this is a kind of good news. There are bad news. Most important one is that the Soviet Union, with its command economy, socialist, communist, very inefficient economy, went bankrupt when it engaged in serious arms competition with the United States. So Gorbachev decided to stop this arms control and change and take major reform. Chinese economy, China says there it's a communist country, but it's not. It's a market-oriented economy. And certainly there are problems, Chinese economy slowing down, you know, shadow banking, all that. But Chinese economy seems to be much more energetic and efficient than the Soviet economy. So if we come to engage in arms competition, full-fledged arms competition, we might lose.
I'm really curious as well, since you did your paper for KEI on the media perspective and the public perspective on some of these security issues. Did you also look at how the media reacted to the situation during the Cold War? And did you find any major similarities there as well?
Well, media was reporting the way it's reported is not the focus of my research, but certainly there is a certain implications of the difference, because during the Cold War, you know, this information revolution had not really happened. So a government could control a flow of information much better, much more effectively than now. For example, there was a one occasion in which U.S. vessel, surface vessel, and a Soviet aircraft carrier exchanged, not fire, but got into a pretty bad skirmishes in the South China Sea in the 1980s. But because the two governments got together and decided to calm down the situation and manage the crisis, it didn't create a big crisis. But today, if you remember what happened in 2010, when there was a Chinese fishing vessel operating inside the Japanese territorial water around the Senkaku Island, and when Japanese Coast Guard vessels approached it, it decided to ram into a Japanese Coast Guard vessel. As a result, kind of crisis erupted. But at first, in order to kind of dampen the tension, the Japanese government decided not to release the videotaped, video coverage of what happened, which was taken by Japanese Coast Guard. But because one of these Coast Guard members decided to leak it, it became a big issue. And when people saw this, visual scene of Chinese fishing vessel ramming into Japanese vessels, it became a highly politicized and emotional issue. So, it got out of control of the government. So I think this is one thing which is different and has been making the situation a little bit more difficult today than during the Cold War time.
I'm also curious if you have any takeaways, I guess, from your research on the Cold War versus what's going on today in Northeast Asia. And are there any ways that you think the current military leaders could learn from the experiences you described during the Cold War period?
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe two or three things. One is that during the Cold War, there was a serious challenge from our side perspective posed by the Soviet Union, but very creative indigenous, number of U.S. Navy officers came up with a new strategy called maritime strategy, which really worked to pressure Soviet military leaders and made it difficult for the Soviet Union to kind of prevail strategically in this in the Pacific. So we can kind of learn lessons from how we came up with the strategy, and there are some of interesting strategic as well as operational innovations, and so we can relearn the lessons. And the second, alliance relationship is important. In order to help the U.S. implement this maritime strategy, Japan did a lot, particularly Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force or Japanese Navy contributed a lot to the execution of, or potential execution of maritime strategy in wartime, which seems to have enhanced deterrence vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And finally, we can learn lessons from peacetime operations. Now, the U.S. Navy is conducting so-called Freedom of Navigation operations, FONOPS. Some people think it's a kind of new operation, but the United States has been doing so since the 1960s and 70s, so it's not there is nothing new to it. So we are taking this measure. But it's really a low-key, basic countermeasure to take to a kind of expansionist activities that are taken by some countries. And so there are actually other steps, additional steps, many more other steps that we can take. And we can, for example, the U.S. and Japan together with other regional partners can enhance and upgrade the level of patrol and surveillance activities. For example, we can conduct larger number of more kind of interesting, well-targeted, focused military exercises, both in terms of enhancing our capabilities, defense capabilities, as well as to signal our willingness and commitment to defend ourselves, maintain peace and stability in this region to the Chinese leaders, particularly those ones who are irresponsible expansionists, hawkish. So I think we can learn lessons from past experience, and we have to certainly, you know, rearrange it to fit the current environment. But I think there are a lot that we can learn.
Okay, great. It's been a really great discussion. I just want to ask you if there's anything else you think the listeners should know about Japan's view on these issues in Northeast Asia.
Well, this is I'm speaking at the Korea Economic Institute, and I've lived and studied in Korea for more than 2 years, and I speak Korean and I love Korea. So I would like to say a word on Korea-Japan relationship. We have been experiencing a lot of difficulties. Takeshima, Tokto issue, the territory issue is important, history issue is certainly important. But while we focus and address these issues, we need to also address in a serious, substantial manner the very important security and strategic, economic, political challenges of the day. And one is North Korea, the other is China. And certainly, you know, now in globalized economic competition, you know, Japan and South Korea has a lot in common. We have the same kind of economic industrial structure. We produce automobiles, we electric appliances. Sometimes we can get into serious competition. So we have to find a way to cooperate very closely and in order to create a win-win relationship.
Okay, great. So as I mentioned, we've had a really great discussion here today on a lot of these really important security issues. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. As always, thank you so much for joining us for this great conversation. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. And do remember that you can go back and listen to our archive of episodes at keia.podbean.com. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll be back again next week with another great episode.